Welcome to the Northeast Christian Podcast. We're so excited that you've decided to check out our weekly messages. We hope that you're challenged and inspired by what you're hearing today. We'd love to have you join us this weekend at one of our campuses or online at northeast.live. For more information on Northeast, visit us at necchurch.org. If you love the Northeast Podcast, subscribe to our channel and leave us a comment or a rating in the Apple Podcast Store. This weekend's message is from Tyler McKenzie. He's the lead pastor here at Northeast.
That is right. So nine services. First one's on December 19th. That is Thursday before the weekend before Christmas Eve. And the reason why we did it is because we did it last year to try to catch folks before they went out of town, because we just assumed that you guys wanted to do Christmas Eve with your church before you went out of town, and it was a packed room, and we're planning for another packed room. So before you go out of town, you know, invite your friends, come. Or if you're in town, 21, 22, 23, 24, we've got eight other amazing services and amazing invite opportunities. Now, can I vent for a second? I mean, you're my people. We're a spiritual family here. Okay, so let me just vent. December is a little bit of an anxious month for me for a variety of reasons. You can put my little calendar up there. First and foremost, we have our Love the Ville Outreach Fund that Adrian just talked about, which starts today, by the way. It's never too early to give to the Love the Ville Outreach Fund, because every year we're waiting into the first week, second week of January for the gifts to come in, and we're wondering, are we going to make it? Did you know that our church gets about 20 to 25% of its income in the month of December alone? So if you can imagine sitting at the end of a fiscal year, just sort of waiting and praying and begging God and hating you guys for a second for making me wait, but then loving you guys at the end for seeing it, then you can know the sort of anxiety that I feel. So it's never too early to give to that big compassion initiative. Then we've got the Eve services. It's God help us, there are nine. But I know I kind of joke around. I love our Eve service. I love the fact that we have 10,000 plus and we get to tell people about Jesus who don't normally get to hear about Jesus. I love that. But we want them to be so good, because you're bringing your friends and your family, so there's a certain amount of pressure with that. So I would just ask you, be praying for those first two. And then if it wasn't already busy and interesting enough in December, we're doing something new this year. Okay, on December 28, 29, which is the weekend between Christmas Eve and New Year's, we're going to do an exclusively online church service that day. Basically, what we want you to do is we want you to have church in your homes. We want you to have church in a coffee shop, church with your small group, church with your family if you're in Virginia or on the other side of the world. We want you to do church in your own context. Now, here's why. Okay, over the last 2 to 3 years, our church has kind of been on the front end of investing a lot in online. We believe that the world's going online, and so we believe that that should be leveraged for the gospel. We shouldn't just sit back here twiddling our thumbs. No, we should do something about it. And so we have, and we've seen our online audience explode. And we've always had two goals when it comes to online. Two. I want you to hear the vision of this. Reach and retention. Reach and retention. We believe online allows us to reach people that we never could have before. It gets us on phone screens, it gets us in living rooms, it gets us on computers that would never darken the doors of our church. Oh, and also, just for the record, before a guest ever visits our church, they check us out online 2 or 3 times, right? It's just a fact of the matter. It's like when you go to a restaurant, you're gonna check the reviews, you're gonna get online and look at the website, right? So in terms of reach, that's the new front end of touching people with Jesus and getting them involved in our spiritual family. We want it to be excellent. We want our first impression to be amazing. On top of that, we know that the world is flatter than ever before, and so you guys travel a lot. And so it is our hope that we're able to retain our people more by putting a great online church service out there. We want you when you have a business trip on the other side of country. We want you when you're visiting family or at the lake during the summer or whatever to still be with us at our church, plugged into the vision, plugged into the discipleship and spiritual formation that we do, just plugged in. And so I think we've done a lot of hard work to get us there. The only interesting thing is that most of you have never experienced it before. And how can you be visionaries and supporters of this, be inviting your friends and utilizing it when you're not here, if you've never experienced it once yourself? So on this kind of strange weekend anyways, where only a third of you show up, December 28, 29, we want you to show up online. Host your own church service. Get with us that day. See the kind of cool stuff we do. We're going to push a lot of cool content that day. There will be stuff for your young kids that will be that our children's ministry is going to be doing. Lots of neat stuff. A sermon, the whole nine yards. So make sure you mark that on your calendar now and check it out. It'll launch December 28th at 5 p.m. and be available for you, and then we'll live stream it at 9 and 11 a.m. if you want to jump in the comments section. Cool? Online audience, cool? Yeah, you guys get to host church that day. So did you guys know that we have somewhere around 1,000-plus people who are engaged in our online audience? When I say engaged, like they're here for the whole service. And half of them are exclusively online. So they're already kind of doing this, like meeting with family and friends and stuff and homes and wherever else. Pretty cool, right? So online church, you guys get to do it that day. All right. Now, that having been said, let's get back down to business to our Christmas sermon series. Last week, we launched a new sermon series called Reputation. And really, this whole series has just been a character study. It's a character study on the Wonder Woman of Christmas, Mary. Because, see, I believe there are certain aspects and traits that are a part of her reputation that if we ever want to earn for ourselves a reputation as a Loveville church, we need to take and make a part of ours. Now, do you guys remember character trait number one that we looked at last week in Mary? Do you guys remember? Anybody? Anybody? Nobody? We're going to go back and preach last week and then this week. So, hope you brought lunch. No, come on. Anybody? Surrender, unconditional surrender. Gabriel shows up, says, "Hi, Mary, I got good news for you." She says, "Time out, you're an angel, I'm freaking out." He says, "Don't freak out, okay? I know I'm an angel, but I've got good news for you, but it's gonna be hard news for you. Because check this out, Mary, your childhood's over. I know you're 13, but you're about to have a baby. And your future is forfeited. Not sure what plans you had for your 20s and into your 30s, but God has different plans. And your reputation is finished. Listen, we know it's a virgin birth, but ain't nobody buying that story, okay? And your marriage may be through. We're going to send an angel to Joseph, but we don't know what he's going to do. And also, you may not live past the age of 14 because the punishment for adultery is death. Hard calling, Mary, but God is calling. He's calling you to change history." And do you remember how Mary responds? Luke chapter 1, verse 38, unconditional surrender. She says, here am I, servant of the Lord. Let it be with me according to your word. And man, I love that. That's the great confession of Christmas, and I hope you all make that your confession this Christmas. See, middle school Mary, she's my hero. When I grow up, I want to be like this young beacon of faithfulness. But that's not all we see in Mary's faithfulness. So today we're going to pick up and look at characteristic number two. Now, we're going to actually just pick up in the scripture right where we left off last week. So we left off in verse 38. So I'm going to read to you verse 39. It's kind of a long passage and we'll stop along the way for some historical context, but it's a fascinating story. Verse 39. It says, after the news from Gabriel, Mary set out and went with haste, to a Judean town in the hill country where she entered the house of Zechariah and greeted Elizabeth. Now pause, little historical context, a few things I want you to note. One, it says Mary went with haste, like boom, boom, boom. She is on the road and quick. In fact, I believe, my humble opinion, that Mary didn't tell anybody. She didn't have time. She didn't tell Joseph at this point what Gabriel said. She didn't tell her mom and dad what had just been said. No, she just goes and she goes to Elizabeth. Now, you want to know why? Why Elizabeth? Why did she go and talk to her first? I believe she goes and talks to her first because Elizabeth was a safe place. Elizabeth was on the inside of the miracle, right? Because what did Elizabeth have in her belly? A baby, right? Now, they were far separated by age. Mary was a virgin birth. Elizabeth was a barren womb. Miraculously conceived, and she had John the Baptist inside of her, right? And Mary had Jesus in her. So Mary knew if there was anybody who would rejoice with her and encourage with her and understand her story, then it would be Elizabeth. So she makes the trip, see Elizabeth. Next slide. It says, when Elizabeth heard Mary's greeting, the child leapt in her womb, like John the Baptist leapt. And Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Spirit and exclaimed with a loud cry, "Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the fruit of your womb. And why has this happened to me that the mother of my Lord comes to me? For as soon as I heard the sound of your greeting, the child in my womb leaped for joy. And blessed is she," I love this line, blessed is anyone really, "but blessed is she who believed there would be a fulfillment of what was spoken to her by the Lord." Now, another quick pause. What happens next is Mary responds to Elizabeth with song. And this is a fascinating peculiarity about the Gospel of Luke. Did you know that Luke's Gospel is the musical of the Christmas stories? You should go read it. There's lots of songs. Okay, so there are four stories of Jesus: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Did you know that only two of them have Christmas stories? Who does not have Christmas stories? Okay, so first off, there's Mark the Grinch, because he just skips right over to the Christmas story and goes straight to adult Jesus. Like, apparently he doesn't like baby Jesus and frankincense and myrrh and all that. And then there's John the artist, who kind of gives us a Christmas story. See, he's an artist, so he has to be different. So instead of giving us a Christmas story, he gives us a poem in his skinny jeans, drinking his flat white. And then there's Matthew and Luke, and they give us normal Christmas stories, but Luke's is a little bit different than Matthew's, because Luke focuses on the character of Mary, and Luke is a musical, like song after song after song. Now, they don't sing every word like Les Mis. It's not Les Mis musical where you're like, can Hugh Jackman not sing for a second, please? But it's a lot of songs. And this is my favorite song. The Magnificat is what we call it. Here's what Mary sings. It says, Mary sang, Magnificat, Magnificat. My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God, my Savior. For he has looked with favor on the lowliness of his servant. Surely from now on, all generations will call me blessed. For the mighty one has done great things for me, and holy is his name. His mercy is for those who fear him from generation to generation. He has sown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the thoughts of their hearts. He's brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He's filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty. He's helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, according to the promise he made to our ancestors, to Abraham and Abraham's descendants forever and ever. And then Mary remained with Elizabeth about 3 months and then returned home. Now, real quick, we're going to get to the content of the song in a second, because it's a beautiful and powerful song. But I want to handle this last historical detail here. It says that Mary stayed with Elizabeth for approximately 3 more months. Does anybody know why 3 more months? Actually, we don't know why, because Luke doesn't tell us why. But what we do know is that when Mary shows up, Elizabeth was 6 months pregnant. So you can do the math. 6 months plus 3 months. Perhaps, just perhaps, Mary stays long enough to see the birth of John the Baptist. We can't be sure of that, but you know, it's kind of assumed there. And what we know for sure is that after this 3 month stay, Mary hits the road, travels back from the Judean hill country to Nazareth, which would have been about a 70 to 80 mile trip in her second trimester. Okay, to put that into context for you, that would be like walking from here to Cincinnati, about 90 miles, here to Lexington, about 70 miles. When you're 13 in your second trimester. Okay, so about half of you have never been pregnant before. So what I did this year was I did some research on medical websites and mom blogs, and what I want to show you is some of the symptoms that a pregnant woman has when she is in her second trimester. According to medicine and moms across the country, it says the following things can be expected: growing belly, nausea, increased urination, and awkward and inappropriate comments from others. men, just keep your mouth shut when you see a pregnant woman. You just think, okay. Back knee, Braxton Hicks contractions, fatigue, a hunger for the Hallmark Channel. Mary didn't have access to that. A baby that decides to sleep when you're awake and also have a dance party when you lay down to sleep. Dizziness, naps, cupcakes, and also emotional volatility. Now, that's a dangerous one for any man to say or read, so I want to be very, very clear here, because my wife may be in the service. I want you to know that she's bore both of our children, both Palmer and Larkin, and during the entirety of both of those 9 month stints, she was 100% a warrior, 100% emotionally stable the entire time. Except for the many times she sent me to the grocery store to buy for her an endless supply of Sunny D. Now, does anybody know what Sunny D is? Okay, it's something that Lindsay never drinks, except for apparently when she's pregnant. And it's the orange juice that's full of sugar that you give 5-year-olds at halftime of their soccer games. You know what I'm talking about? That's Sunny D. And it was like, I need some Sunny D now. Get to the store. Also, she hated Chipotle during her pregnancy, which was very hurtful. But anyways, so that's focus, Tyler. That's the historical context, okay? Not Sunny D, but Mary's like in her second try, and she's making their way, and she's singing with Elizabeth. Now, let's get to the content of the song. Okay, because the content of this song is full of fire and truth for you today. It's known as the Magnificat. The reason why we call the song Magnificat is because that's the Latin word for to glorify or to magnify. The first words that Mary sings, Magnificat. And you probably recognize the song. You can play the clip. We sing it every year in our Christmas Eve experience. This is a recording from last year. It's one of my favorite moments in the service. I anticipate it. I weep every year. Not just because of the beautiful form of the song, but also because of the meaning and the woman behind it. I would say to you that while the song is beautiful and powerful, it will enrapture you with the soprano operatic style. Its form will grab your heart. I believe that the soft, sweet tenderness of it may have allowed one of the primary themes of the Magnificat to escape it. In short, I wonder if the form of the Magnificat does no justice to justice, which is the main theme of Mary's Magnificat. Let me be clear with you guys here. The theme of Mary's Magnificat is radical kingdom justice. And sure, justice should be pervaded in art. Sure, it should be sung in an opera. Sure, it should be written in poetry. And sure, it should also be shouted from the rooftops with a megaphone. Now, justice is a buzzword in our culture. It's a buzzword in the church. It's a buzzword in politics. And rightfully so. Because justice is vital, important. Dictionary definition is this: justice is giving people what they deserve. Okay, what do human beings deserve? Okay, give it to them. That's what justice is. And every just society tries to do that. Every church, every country worth its weight in salt should try to do that. Our country is founded on liberty and justice for all, right? Which means that from the highest high to the most invisible and marginalized person, everyone should be treated equally. Everyone should be looked at equally through the side of the law. It's important to our country, right? But if it's important to our country, I believe it should be even more important to our church. Because from the very beginning of Scripture all the way to the end, what we see is a God of justice who says that he builds a kingdom built on justice. And one day, justice will reign in perfection in heaven. At Micah chapter 6, verse 8, the prophet says this. He says, what does the Lord require of you? Would anybody like to know that? I'd like to know what the Lord requires of me. Okay, do justice. Do justice. Jesus says this in Luke chapter 18, verse 7. He says, will not God grant justice to his chosen ones who cry to him day and night? Will he delay long in helping them? I tell you, he will quickly grant justice. Justice to them. So here's your kingdom truth for today. And I believe this sort of mission-driven theology should make its way into all of our hearts in this room. I believe that one of the essential callings of the Christian is to join with King Jesus in establishing his kingdom of justice. To join with Jesus in giving people what they deserve, or more specifically, what he, the King, says every human being deserves. So maybe a better question for us today would be this then. What does Jesus say people deserve? Well, Mary shows us the way here. And sure, it's beautiful in a ballad, but I also think that it needs to be chanted in a protest. I also think that Mary needs to get on her soapbox, pull out her megaphone, and with her chest voice, belt it at the top of her lungs. Because this is a cry for justice. Kingdom, Magnificat, Jesus, justice. That's what we see here. Now, for those of you who don't see it yet, let me help you see it. Let's pretend for a second that Mary had a completely different audience for her song. When she sings the song, original context, it's to Elizabeth, who's a family member on the inside of the miracle, safe place, right? But let's pretend that Mary sang it before the corrupt powers of her day. Wonder how they would have responded. Let's pretend that Herod the Great has a hearing of Mary's song. When I say Herod the Great, I'm talking about like the Herod the Great of Jesus' birth story. The baby killer Herod, who killed all the 2-year-olds and younger in Bethlehem just to keep his throne. That nasty, violent, vile man. Yeah, let's pretend that he has a hearing. And let's pretend that he invites his boss, Caesar Augustus, the emperor of the Roman Empire. The same Caesar that said, I'm the son of God, I'm the savior of the world, I'm the bringer of peace on earth. Yes, that's what Caesar claimed of himself. And let's pretend that they also invite all the chief priests, Pharisees, scribes, who were part of the rich establishment in Jerusalem that was in league with Rome and would eventually one day crucify Jesus. Let's pretend they set up a few rows of chairs, and in front of this room of powerful men, Mary walked on stage, 13 years old, with her little baby bump, and she said to them this, this is a song about my king. To Caesar, the powerful will be brought down to the ground from high up to down low. To Herod, the so-called great, the rich will show up full but be sent away empty. To the corrupt religious establishment, I want you to know that he's looked at me with favor and looked at you with anger. The lowly, the servant, the woman, he blesses here and now, but the smug hierarchy, he judges. And to all y'all, listen up now, to all y'all, his mercy is only for those who fear him. God's strong arm will scatter the proud. Are you beginning to see? You beginning to see the zeal, the subversiveness of Mary's song here? Hey, over or under 1 minute, how long does Mary survive after singing that song in front of that audience? Fun fact for you, did you know that in 1980, the Guatemalan government actually outlawed the recitation of the Magnificat in their country? Why? Because it was too politically subversive. See, if you've ever lived in a context where you're denied basic liberties and you're told who you can worship and when you can worship, you know that calling for justice is an act of treason. And Mary confesses her treason, she announces her king, and she awaits his hope. Magnificat, magnificat, magnificat. Did you see the Blessed Mary last week? See the Blessed Mother? You guys here? This is the artistic depiction that has been immortalized into history of what Mary looked like. Interesting, right? Sweet and kind, tender and soft, bleeding heart, somber face, holding flowers, lipstick, and eyeshadow. White Mary. Yeah, she was in the Middle East 2,000 years ago, but that's where we got white Jesus from, obviously, white Mary. And this is the Mary we all remember, right? This is the Mary codified in history, and yet I believe that this swings and misses on the revolutionary we see here. In fact, you know what I believe? I believe that this version of Mary right here oppresses women more than it empowers women, because it ordains quietness and timidity and passivity as godly values of a Christian woman, when Mary was far from quiet or timid or passive in this song. Magnificat, justice, kingdom, Jesus. That's Mary. And middle school Mary, she's my hero. When I grow up, I want to be like her. Now, here's the next question I want to pose to you. What's the sort of justice that Mary sings about here? What does it look like? How is it played out on the ground? Well, there are many aspects that we could parse out of this, but I want to give you three things briefly today about kingdom justice that I think Mary shows us in her song. Okay. Here's the first one. Mary sings to us that kingdom justice is hope. Kingdom justice is hope. It's everything that we wish for, everything that we fight over, everything that we want this side of heaven and in government and an empire, but that we just can't seem to grasp on, right? Kingdom justice is that hope. Now, I don't know if you've ever noticed, but in our country and in our like governmental context, no one can agree on the definition for justice. Right, you got politicians over here and over there, you got judges and then judges that overturn the rulings of those judges, and you got competing news stations, and everybody claims to be on the side of justice, but there's no consensus around what the definition for it actually is, which is why there's so much argumentation. Now, fascinatingly enough, most of our government officials would agree that justice is like a supreme virtue for our country. Where we get sideways is how to apply those principles and values that are critical for justice. So I've made just like a list of values that I think are embedded in justice. This is not an exhaustive list, this is just a few. And most of us would agree that these have their place in a just society. It's how we prioritize and apply them that we would disagree on, right? So you got the freedom of choice. I should be allowed, within reason, to choose what I do with my life, with my money, with my body, with my time, with my skills. I should have the dignity of choice within reason. You got personal responsibility. I should be held responsible for no one's actions but my own. But I should be held responsible. Actions have consequences. You got restitution and rehabilitation. People should be punished for wrongdoing, no doubt, but punishment should not be cruel and unusual. They should have the goal of restitution and rehabilitation so people can heal, get another chance. You got equity and opportunity. A just society takes into consideration the fact that not everybody has the same starting point. Right? Like kids in our city right now could be born 10 minutes apart from each other. And if you get just the right neighborhoods, then one kid will have an exponentially greater chance of growing up, learning how to read, graduating high school, staying out of the criminal justice system, and getting a job and keeping it, while the other kid has almost no chance. Just because of the neighborhood they're born into. And then there's also basic human rights. In a just society, it's believed that humans should be treated like humans. Not animals. Not disposable units of productivity. Not property, humans. Now, again, like all this right here, most of us would agree. We would agree that in a just society, each one of these values has its place. But where we go awry and start, you know, experiencing the tension is when we start talking about the application of it, right? So let me give you a few examples of the application, okay? Here's a question for you. What should be on the list of basic human rights? And I'm not asking you to answer this out loud. I'm just asking. I'll tell you what, if we put a hot mic in the middle of the room and we allowed people to digress on their opinions on this, we would see a sifting in the room very quickly, wouldn't we? How about this one? When should the government infringe upon your freedom of choice? When? So here's some big arguments around this one. Some say the government should not infringe on what I do with my money. They shouldn't make me pay welfare or funnel my tax dollars to places I don't like. Here's another big argument on this one. The government should not infringe on how I define marriage. 10, 15 years ago, the LGBTQ community was yelling this at the top of their lungs. 10, 15 years later, the church is yelling this at the top of their lungs. But everyone's yelling this. What's a just society say? How about this one? Personal responsibility. So you'll hear some white folks say, racism was awful, no doubt about it, but why am I personally responsible for something my great-great-great-grandpa did? But then on the flip side, you hear brown and black folks saying, yeah, exactly. Why should I still suffer today because of something your great-great-great-grandpa did? How's a just society parse it out? Equity and opportunity. Here's a question. How much money should the government tax from its citizens to help the underprivileged who have been victimized by the system for years? What does a just society require of us? Or on the flip side of that, what about those who take advantage of the welfare system, which is inevitable? There's always people who cheat the system and get the monies, the crooks out there, who take the monies out of the hands of the kids and the communities we want it in. What does a just society do about that? Or how about this one? Are there crimes that are beyond restitution and rehabilitation? Or how about this one? And this really gets at the heart of it all. It's like the big overarching question when it comes to determining a definition for justice. In a pluralistic society like ours, where there's freedom of religion, whose moral system wins out? The Christians? The Muslims? The atheists? Whose? The majority? It's the majority that should rule, Tyler. Okay, what if the majority's evil? The majority's been evil in countries past. Should majority rule? Who wins out? Okay, now, you see the tension there? Some of you are experiencing the tension right now. Look, it's not my goal today to litigate these issues, right? I'm not going to litigate these issues from this stage, at least not at this moment. That's what Facebook's for. Okay, you want to litigate these issues? I encourage you, go to the comments section of a blog, the cesspool of the universe, and just throw your opinion out there, and you'll have plenty of people who will join you. I can promise you on that. Okay, I'm not here to litigate those today. I want to show you what Mary's vision is. Because you know the vision that Mary casts for us? When you read the Magnificat, this song of kingdom justice, what you don't see is Mary giving us different values or even better values than this. All of these values we see and more are in her song. You see the freedom to choose. in her song. You see personal responsibility, restitution, and rehabilitation in her song. You see equal opportunity in her song. You see basic human rights in her song. Go look for it, okay? So what Mary does here is she doesn't give us better values. What Mary sings of here is a better king, a better judge who can actually do it. Kingdom justice is hope. That there actually is a king of kings out there that can get done everything that we're arguing and hoping and wishing for. Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6 tells us of this king. It says, "For a child has been born for us, a son given to us, and the government rests on his shoulders." His shoulders. He's named Wonderful Counselor, also Mighty God, also Everlasting Father, also Prince of Peace. And his government, I love this line, his government shall just grow continually. And there shall be endless peace for the throne of David and his kingdom. He will establish and uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time onward and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. So you see this king. This is amazing. You know what kind of king this is? This is the kind of king who is immune to corruption and unimpeachable in his character. This is the kind of king who is fair. No partisanship, no grandstanding, all right? Okay, no towing the party line, just righteousness and peace. This is the kind of king who is powerful, more powerful in his arm, Mary sings, than all of his most powerful competitors combined. And this is the kind of king who is wise and capable of discerning how to distribute justice with both nuance and perfection to all of humanity. Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. That's the king. And you know what? If some of you are like, man, I would love to have a politician like that this year, Mary has good news of great joy for you. She says, he's growing in my womb. It's hope, man. Kingdom justice is hope. It's hope. So look, as our culture continues to blaze hotter with political fire, and it's only going to get worse as we move downhill into November 2020. I just want to remind you what king should have your primary hope. Some of y'all in here are like, if Trump gets reelected, the world's coming to an end. Some of you are like, if Trump doesn't get reelected, the world's coming to an end. And I just want to let you know that there's only one king who's going to bring the world to an end. That king, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. So again, as the political fires blaze, hey, just make sure Jesus is informing your politics and your politics aren't informing your Jesus, and we'll get it right. We'll get it right. Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. He's the hope that we're all grasping for, the justice that we're all praying for. Here's the second thing kingdom justice teaches us. Kingdom justice shows us that God's gonna win history. Kingdom justice wins history. It does. You're on the right side of history with kingdom justice. I can promise you that. Now, that sounds egotistical. No doubt about it, but I believe it's more historical than egotistical, because pretty much everything Mary says in the song has come true and will continue to come true. I'll give you one case study on this. In Luke chapter 1, verse 51, this is the most historically provable, but also the most just surprisingly outrageous claim that Mary makes in her song. She makes a claim that there will be a great reversal of power in Jesus. She says, he has shown strength with his arm. He's scattered the proud in the thoughts of their hearts. He's brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He's filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty-handed. Do you see the reversal of power here? Now, case study for you. Let's take the king of Mary's day, King Herod, who's in charge of the province, Herod the Great, and let's compare him to Jesus of Nazareth. And you tell me, who won history? Herod's royal titles were the following. He was called Herod the Great because he was a great diplomat, served in the most politically volatile region in all the Roman Empire for 40 years. That's special. The definitive biography written on Herod the Great this day and age is called Herod the Great, King of the Jews, Friend of the Romans. Because that's what sort of diplomat he was. He was able to put one foot in both worlds. Now, what about Jesus? Well, Jesus is not known as great by his contemporaries, but he did have a different sort of greatness. He said, the servant of many, that's who's truly great. He was also called King of the Jews once on the cross. As he hung there, there was a sign nailed to his head in three different languages. It said, King of the Jews, King of the Jews, ha, 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 King of the Jews. And he certainly was not known as a friend of the Romans. They crucified him. But he was known as a friend of sinners. And you tell me, who won history? Herod the Great, king of the Jews, friend of the Romans, or Jesus, the crucified king, friend of the sinners? Herod's ruling philosophy was a common one for powerful people. Power up. Get the power, then use the power to keep the power. Herod had seven legitimate sons, legitimate being the key word there, and he killed three of them out of his paranoia that they were usurping his throne. Can you imagine being a part of Herod's Thanksgiving dinner table? Hey, mommy, where is half-brother Joe this Thanksgiving? Don't ask, honey. Oh, by the way, Herod killed his favorite wife. That's right, I said favorite wife, Miriam, for the same thing. Paranoia that she was usurping his throne. Because that's what he did. He powered up. That was his ruling philosophy. And Jesus had a different one. It wasn't power up. It was love down. He stooped down, became one of us, stooped down even further, became our sin. And you tell me, who won history? Was Herod the Great able to power his way into the heart of history? Or was Jesus capable of loving his way into the heart of history? What about their legacies? If you go to the Holy Land today, you actually see the legacy of Herod even still. He was one of the great architects and builders of his time. He renovated the temple complex. He also had massive palaces everywhere. It's really fascinating. You go tour the Holy Land, you'll spend like 20% of your time in like Herod's palaces because they're pretty fantastic. I've been there. I've been to several of them. This is a picture of Masada. It was his desert fortress. That's a historical reconstruction of what it might have looked like. This is a picture of the actual ruins there. He had some balconies on the front end, you see, so he could overlook the desert. Many people believe this fortress was impenetrable. Herod also had some beachfront property in Caesarea Maritima. This is where the paparazzi would catch him in pictures. His mankini, getting a little R&R with the wives. It's an opulent place. Fascinating. He also had a property, this is an interesting one, called the Herodium. Again, this is a historical diagram of it. If you go to the next slide here, this is a picture of actually the hill that it sat upon. And as I stood on top of that hill in the ruins and looked down, it's interesting. You know what you can see from the Herodium ruins? Bethlehem. And I thought, oh, how ironic. As Herod sat on his throne in opulence, Jesus was being laid in a manger, a food trough for livestock with manure and straw. And who won? Herod's ruins or Jesus's manger? You tell me. The answer's simple. Right? In fact, if we could rewind 2,000 years back in time to like AD 0, which is not a year, so AD 1, and we had like Jesus on one hand and Herod the Great on the other hand, and I asked you, hey, you got to put your money on one of these horses. Which one are you betting on? Most of you would make the right decision. You would say, Mary, appreciate the song and sincerity, but I'm going with Herod the Great here because he's got real potential. And while that would have been the smart decision, that would have been the absolutely wrong decision. 90% of us walked into church, they didn't even know who Herod was. You're like, oh, I learned something about Herod today. Cool. So people all the time are saying, Tyler, Christianity, religion, you're on the wrong side of history. Tyler, Orthodox doctrine, you're on the wrong side of history. Tyler, scriptural authority, you're on the wrong side of history. And I think to myself, you want to bet? You want to bet? Because here we stand. 2,000 years later, 2 billion strong, every continent on the planet Earth, and his government continues to increase. Which leads us to our final point today. Kingdom justice offers mercy. Offers mercy. Hey, listen, kingdom justice is not for those who deserve it, it's for those who want it. And that's the counterintuitive thing about Christianity that makes it different than any other religious or governmental system. It's for those who want it. Do you want it? Luke chapter 1, verse 50. Mary sings, his mercy is for those who've earned it. Oh, no, sorry. His mercy is for those who are morally upstanding in the eyes of God and in the eyes of the law. No, that's not what it says either. It says his mercy is for those who fear him. Fear is something like revere, what you would do before a king, right? So do you fear? Do you revere? Have you chosen your king? Because you get to choose. C.S. Lewis said it like this once. Every person will look to God and either say, thy will be done or my will be done. And then God and his justice will honor your decision. So do you. Luke 1:54, Mary sings, "He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, according to the promise he made to our ancestors, to Abraham and to Abraham's descendants forever." Now, why is she bringing Abraham into this conversation of mercy? Well, I'll tell you why. Because she's looking back to the great promise of Abraham, the promise that started the people of God, the people of Israel. Genesis 12, verse 3, God looks at Abraham and he says, "All the families on earth will be blessed through you." Now, let me give you a little cultural context of 12:3 here. You know what comes before Genesis 12? Genesis 1 through 11, very good. Yes, and in Genesis 1 through 11, what you see is a good God create a good world, and then human beings mess it up. We sin, and then we get like kicked out of the garden, and then there's like murder, and then everybody's wicked, and then empire comes together to try to ascend to the heights of God. And God scatters everybody at the Tower of Babel, but then in Genesis 12, he goes to Abraham and he says, "I've not given up on you. I will make a way for you. I will extend mercy and bless the nations through your descendants," or for your through your great descendant, Abraham. Mercy will be extended if you want it. And that's the great question of kingdom justice. Do you want it? I pray this church wants it. Maybe a better question would be this: have you ever asked for it? Because you gotta ask for it. In the New Testament, it tells us that baptism is that asking. Baptism is simple, it's a question. It's asking God to do for you what you can't do for yourself. Wash me clean, make me new. Give me mercy. And he always answers yes. And I pray we ask for it, because let me tell you something, church, we'll never earn for ourselves a reputation as a Loveville church, and we will never establish kingdom justice in the city of Louisville until it is established in every heart in this room. That's how kingdom justice makes its way out, one human heart at a time. Is it in your heart? Here's what people will tell you. On your favorite news stations. Here's what people will tell you in editorials online. Here's what people with hundreds of thousands of followers on social media will tell you. They'll tell you that justice is established through the acquisition of wealth, through awareness, through the right technology, and through the right politicians and policies. That's what they'll tell you. And none of those things are inherently bad, like political influence, wealth, technology. Those things are all morally neutral. But what makes them good or bad are the hands that leverage it. So you know what we need? More fundamental than getting the right people in office or the right technology in place is growing the right human beings, growing the right hearts. And that is the fundamental mission of the church. The church is God's plan A. There's no plan B. So let me be clear here. Kingdom justice makes its way out into the world after it makes its way into the hearts of the church. Is it in your heart? Have you accepted it in your heart? Kingdom justice doesn't start with politics. It starts with the people of the church. So have you joined your church? Hey, big compassion offering coming up here shortly. 100% of it going to justice in our city. Join with us. Hey, hundreds of serve opportunities in this church and outside this church every single week. Join with us. Hey, baptistry over there, water's warm. Promise, the heater works. Join with us. Join with us in bringing kingdom justice. Because we'll never establish it unless it starts in your heart and in this room right here. See, that's one thing Mary didn't know. Mary, did you know? She didn't know that God would establish justice through the church. But this side of the cross, this side of the resurrection, this side of the Great Commission, and Pentecost, we know that we're part of his plan to change the world. So here's what I want you to do. Will you stand with me? And I want to close, make our closing prayer, a recitation of Mary's Magnificat. But I think one that might be a little bit more appropriate for the church, this side of an empty tomb. I'll say the part in whites, you say the part in highlight. Let this be our prayer, church. Our souls magnify the Lord, and our spirits rejoice in Jesus, our Savior. Surely from now on, all generations will call us blessed. Jesus' mercy is for those who fear him from generation to generation. Jesus will show strength with his arm. Jesus will scatter the proud in the thoughts of their hearts. Jesus will bring down the powerful from their thrones. And Jesus will lift up the lowly. Jesus will fill the hungry with good things. And Jesus will send the rich away empty. Jesus has helped his servant, the church, in remembrance of his mercy. This is the word of the Lord. Let it be true in this church. Adrian.
Hey, thank you all so much for being here today. We really are so glad that you were here. If you heard something today that you need to talk about or if you need prayer, we've got staff and elders standing by in the fireside room just outside these doors over here. And if you are here for the very first time, we would really love to meet you. So please stop by the kiosk in the center of the lobby and say hi. Go out and love the Ville. Have a great week.